Hello everyone, welcome back to the Crash MotoGP podcast. And there is no action this week, but we have plenty to talk about. And first of all, we're going to start with a report that was in the Financial Times. And at the time we're recording this podcast, we don't know if there's been any official news yet, but essentially, Liberty Media, the owners of F1, are close to agreeing a 4 billion euro deal for MotoGP. So that would be to buy the Dorna share in MotoGP. And yeah, Pete, we'll start with you first. That is very big news. And what's your initial take on it?
As you say, John, this has been going on in the background, hasn't there? There's been these rumours of a possible sale and everything else, and it seems like it's getting closer and there might be something more to it than just the normal rumours. We were talking before we came on air, weren't we, about what Liberty is and all that kind of thing, what they might do. But just to sort of confirm, really, in MotoGP, you have the Grand Prix Commission that makes the rules, don't you? And that's the FIM at Dorna. And then the MSMA. So there's sort of four parties in there. So this is not like if you buy a chunk of the commercial rights, which is what we're talking about, isn't it? That you automatically could make all the rules different. It's not as simple as that. But certainly, if it goes ahead, you have to assume that the idea is to sort of mimic what's gone on in F1 and see if you can do it on two wheels. And I mean, I haven't followed the F1 side too closely, but it certainly seems like in recent years, it's got a lot more popular. And so maybe they think, you know, MotoGP has some untapped potential in that regard.
Definitely. And Rob, like Pete says, they are essentially the marketing behind F1, and they have done an incredible job since they bought it over from Bernie Ecclestone in 2017. And you know what it's been like. I watch F1, you watch F1. The amount of social media eyes and numbers, it's just been incredible. And to see this, you know, I think mostly it's a positive step if it goes ahead. Would you think the same?
I would. Like you said, the popularity in Formula One right now, even in a time where, you know, a lot of people will probably say that throughout the history of F1, there's always been dominant periods. And we've sort of been going through another one in the last few years, pretty much since 2021, with Red Bull dominating. But even so, the popularity and the way they've been able to get eyes on the sport has been incredible. And I think from that side of things, for MotoGP, it could only be a good thing. You look at, you know, the introduction of Drive to Survive on Netflix. Yeah. They've done so much in a short amount of time as well, that I think it can only be a good thing for MotoGP in terms of just getting more eyes on the sport and bringing more attention to the sport and just growing it in general. And that's the biggest takeaway. When you look at what they've done with F1, that's what they've been able to do. So I think it would be a massive step forward for MotoGP, who are already in a very good place. There's more eyes on MotoGP. I mean, we saw the numbers just in Portimao for Miguel Oliveira. Since he's been there, every year it's been getting more popular in Portugal. And if Liberty Media take over, I think that's only going to get bigger.
Yeah, you could even see that. Like, I seen the MotoGP post they put out on Sunday. It was around 42% of an increase of attendance at the Grand Prix as well. So it just shows you MotoGP is trending in the right direction. But like, people are kind of worrying about it. Our fans are saying that, you know, they're going to come in, they're going to ruin the sport. You know, they can't do that. They don't have, as Pete said, they don't have the regulation control to just change bikes and everything. That is with the FIM and, like say, the other bodies that we have in MotoGP. But yeah, I think it's a positive step. You know, the Financial Times, they wouldn't be reporting it if it wasn't true. You know, they have, of course, an incredible reputation for things like this in business. So let's see what happens. Like we say, at the time of recording, nothing is official yet. But yeah, one to keep an eye on, and let's see how it unfolds. But this week's podcast.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
The podcast is about Pedro Acosta, the rise of Pedro Acosta, and Pete, you know, it's hard to believe, really, that he's only been in Grand Prix racing. This is his fourth season, and he's already won two world titles. What is your first sort of memory of Acosta when he joined Moto3?
I think probably like most people, it would be that win from pit lane in Qatar, wouldn't it? I know he was on the podium the week before. It was his back-to-back races, wasn't it? But I think if you're asking for the first memory, bang, straight away, that pit lane win, unbelievable, even now. And certainly when I was speaking to Hervé Poncharel last week, that was the moment also when he, you know, really knew Acosta from there was something special. We've seen guys win as rookies coming into Moto3, but to do it from pit lane, yeah, that was pretty amazing.
Yeah, and Rob, same question goes to you. What is your first memory of Pedro Acosta?
Like Pete said, the way he, you know, joined the championship and introduced himself with the win in Qatar. And then, you know, he had five races in, I think he had four wins. And that's where the bulk of his success in Moto3 in that rookie season came. But his consistency, and I think the biggest takeaway for me, you know, because he's still a teenager 4 years later in MotoGP, but the way he came into that championship and dealt with pressure and the way he's dealt with it throughout is probably the biggest takeaway for me. It's, we've not seen many riders be able to achieve the results that he has so quickly, but in turn, the consistency and the way he's done it under pressure is someone much beyond their years. And I think that's been the most impressive thing for me.
Yeah, and just to add my thoughts on it, it is, of course, that race in Doha that he did have. You know, I have the stats here. He started from pit lane. He was a bit of a naughty boy. I was saying the peak before. I had to refresh some memory. You know, he got a penalty for starting the pit lane because he was irresponsibly riding in practice. At the start of the first lap, he was 9.2 seconds off the leading group. And you think, you know, there was a group of them that were all in the pit lane and they just kind of pushed each other along and he headed that. But the way he won that race, he just arrived into the pack and it was just like, I'm here, I'm going to win it. It was like, once he got there, there was no stopping him. And yeah, his rookie year, like Rob said, he got most of the wins early on and then did go through a bit of a lull where it kind of tested his mentality, Pete. And for someone so young, you know, he was 17 by the time he won the world title in Moto3. He showed so much maturity compared to other riders in the class that I don't think many people really would have seen. Is there anyone you can think of, Pete, in the past that shown this in the lower classes especially?
I don't think so as a rookie, no. I mean, we're used to people having that first learning year, aren't we? And then the second year you go for the title, you look at guys like Rossi, things like that. That was the sort of pattern that he followed, wasn't it? You might get some wins in the first year, but you're too up and down to really go for the championship. And as you guys were saying, what was impressive was perhaps by the time he got to the second half of the year and had all that championship pressure, he still dealt with it, wasn't it? Because that was when the pressure came for the championship. It was, look, you can see the end of the season now. It's not far away and you're the favourite now. And that's when people can really start to crack and start to feel the nerves. And he didn't. He dug in and he got the job done. And so everybody then had big expectations for Moto2, didn't they? Too big, probably. And he also put, I think, too much pressure on himself in that Moto2 debut year. But I think that the difficult times that he had there, and I'm sure you're going to come on to it in a minute, Jordan, that's actually stood him in good stead now for the pressure that you have in MotoGP.
You know, and Rob, just finishing off on the Moto3 season, I think back to the races that, you know, there was that race in Texas where they had that massive crash on the back straight that time, and he was involved in that, and he was so lucky to not hurt himself, because I forget who it was Jeremy Alcoba and was it Dennis Onchu, and there was a lot of weaving on the straight, and whatever happened, and he got caught up in that and actually rode over a bike and ended up in the Armco, essentially. And he just, you feared the worst, then it just cut and he was okay. You know, for even the mentality at that age, to have such a big crash and such a scary moment in your first year of Grand Prix racing shows a lot of, you know, mental toughness as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've seen that, you know, in the way in his first year of Moto2, following that, how he dealt with injury. We've seen him be able to overcome very difficult situations given his age. That's the big thing. You know, a rider, let's take Marc Marquez, for example, when he had the shoulder injury, he was very much into his MotoGP career, had won a lot of world championships, was accustomed to being at the front and accustomed to being in the paddock and having all eyes around him. Acosta, it was very different. Yes, there was expectation, even going through that season in Moto3 and when that incident happened. But I think that that ability to sort of switch that off and just treat it as like a one-off, something that won't happen again, and just get back to racing and almost forget about it, is something that not many people, not just in general, would be able to do, but a lot of other racers might struggle with. But he's, whatever has come up in his career so far, he's been able to process and move on from very, very quickly. And yeah. I think that's why his trajectory has gone the way it has, and he's been able to adapt and move past things very quickly.
Yeah, and just to finish off the Moto3 season, so he finished off with 6 wins. He won the world title. He was the second rookie to win the lightweight world class since Loris Capirossi in 1990. You know, and the crazy stat is there were 17 years and 165 and 166 days. So literally one day between them in the stats as well, which is a pretty cool thing. But as Pete said, you know, Moto2, Pete, it's a difficult class, you know, when we see that transition. And he did struggle at the start, but they, soon after that, you know, it was around his sixth race at Mugello, he won it. And we've seen this pattern before. Marc Marquez went through something similar in 2011. You know, he really struggled at the start, and then he got that first win in Le Mans, and it just changed his season. But then, you know, looking at Acosta, he was unlucky with injury. And it's comparable to Marquez in 2011, who had, of course, diplopia, and it cost him the world title. But yeah, Acosta went through that similar transition period, don't you think?
Yeah, and the big difference with that motor, that first motor 2 year, was all the expectation. And that's why, coming to this year, he doesn't want to say, you know, this is, I want to be in the front two rows on the grid at the next race, so I want to be finishing in the top five. Or this is the reason, is because he's going back to that Moto2 year where he came in rookie champion, everyone going, you can win this, you know, you can make it two in a row as a rookie, and he was with the AO team still, so he started to believe all the hype a little bit too much. And then he struggled, as you say. It was the first half a dozen races, not even, I don't think, anywhere near the podium in terms of the results.
Yeah.
As you say, it all came good for him at Mugello. So then it was okay. Now he's back on course. Then he has the training injury, breaks his leg, and that's the title over, isn't it? But then he comes back and he proves that he can master the Moto2 bike, gets the wins, and everything's then in place for the following year. But I mean, it's also a big step, Moto3 to Moto2, isn't it? It's probably the biggest step between the 100%. Classes. Three times the engine size. Throw in some electronics as well and all that kind of stuff. So it is a big step. I think he maybe underestimated it a little bit because of almost how easy things had been in Moto3 as a rookie, winning in that first year. But yeah, I think that was a key moment in his career, and it's influencing why now he's just going in with his mind clear to in each MotoGP race, not putting that pressure on himself. Because as he said, I think he was at the Spain test, he said, look, the only time I put expectations on myself was that rookie Moto2 year, and look what happened. So he's not making that same mistake again, which also fits in with his sort of personality of he learns from everything, doesn't he? He doesn't make the same mistake twice.
Yeah, and I suppose the environment that he was in, Rob, it was the best environment possible. You know, he's came through his earlier years in the Moto3, Moto2 with the Red Bull KTM IO team. And I suppose there's no better place for someone who has that much talent. We've seen it with Marc Marquez in the past. He went through it in 125. Aki Ayo is an incredible manager of talent. And having the struggles, like Pete said, in the first year of Moto2, you know, he was able to be grounded by Aki Ayo to keep that focus still. And how crucial do you think that has been for his development? Like you say, he has struggled with injury. And Pete said, you know, he broke his femur and missed 2 rounds, but still came back and shown, you know, the talent was still there and his mentality was right going into 23. What's your thoughts?
I think it's been huge. As you said, there's been a lot of riders who have gone through that, let's say, development school with Aki Ayo, and he's been not only crucial in having an eye for talent and spotting the right riders. And, you know, I was going to bring up the point of Acosta ended 2022 as the fastest Moto2 rider and then was dominant last season. And we've seen other riders, not only in Moto2 who are now in MotoGP, but other riders who have gone through that system with Aki Ayo, like Miguel Oliveira, Brad Binder, who didn't win a title in Moto2. And look at the success they've had in MotoGP. and Acosta seems to be following that path. I think that the impact Akiayo has in terms of, you know, his team is known for winning in Moto2. They're one of the best teams and they're sort of a winning machine. And the way they operate, I think, is crucial for a young rider. And I think the way, especially at the age Acosta was, to help mold Acosta into sort of this rider who is grounded, has got a little bit of, you know, cocky confidence to him, and he knows his talent, but he also knows what he needs to do, how he needs to apply himself. I think that's a big learning curve that he got through that sort of Akiayo school.
Yeah, like Rob says, Pete, the Moto 2 class, you need, you think back in the past, the 250s as well. We've seen riders like Jorge Lorenzo, Danny Pedrosa, even Casey Stoner. You know, the first time when he went up to 250, he struggled. But then, you know, he dropped back down to 125, had that learning year in 2000, and I think it was 2004, where it was Dovizioso Lorenzo. Then they all moved up together. The class is such a difficult class with talent. And how do you think it can shape a career, that intermediate class? Is it one that can elevate you to even greater things, or can you just sink? It's one of those classes, isn't it?
I think you're exactly right, John. I think you can almost call it make or break. I mean, look at some of the guys that have come up even as champions of Moto3, and they really struggled. And we can see some on the grid now even, who, you know, were being praised as the next big thing for MotoGP in a few years, and they haven't really shown anything like that potential in Moto3, in Moto2. So it really is. It's a make or break class. All the MotoGP manufacturers also know the bikes are pretty much the same, aren't they? Okay, you've got the speed up chassis and the Kalex, but generally, it's a good gauge of talent, isn't it? Because everyone's on the same machinery, pretty much. Obviously, the tyres are all the same as well. So, it's if you deliver in that class, in that environment, you definitely get the attention of the MotoGP teams, and, you know, for good reason. And, Acosta, okay, that first year, it didn't go to plan, but he did get the first win. He became the youngest MotoGP, Moto2 winner, didn't he? So it was something there for him, at least.
Exactly. And like you say, the records that he has, I don't think he really understands. I don't think he really, not really cares, but like you look at just even going back as far, he was Red Bull Rookies Champion too, and he was third in that same year in CEV. You know, his CEV is so just, it's a glittering CEV in terms of just for how long he's only been racing. It's incredible. From this podcast, when it's recorded, he has 16 victories, 28 podiums, 2 world championships in 4 years of Grand Prix racing. And it's just incredible when you think about it. And Rob, going into 23, he was the fastest rider. And sometimes it can break people, you know, that expectation. But straight out the gate, wins in Portimao last year, and that set the tone for the year, didn't it?
It did. And even to use an example of how Acosta was able to manage the pressure going into the year where he was expected to win, which he did, let's look at Fermín Aldeguer this season. Obviously, the Ducati news has been great for him. And he finished last year with Acosta being the top rider. And obviously, his own mistake in Portimao. But he had a disaster in Qatar. Was off the podium in Portimao. And those are not the results we expected at all. But Acosta, it was a case of ended 2022 the way he would have liked to have started the season. And then it was almost, he didn't get caught up in how he ended that season and whether he could do it again. He just rolled with the punches, essentially, and was just, from the get-go, the rider to beat, and showed blistering pace. The sort of pace that backs up, you know, those stats that you mentioned, all the wins and podiums he's had, which, for his age and his experience in the championship, and to have done it across classes, it's not like he's just stayed in Moto3 and generated all those stats. He's almost, the way you look at his progression, he's almost bypassing the learning curve, which is crazy to think about. Because every time...
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
He steps on a bigger bike. He acknowledges there's a learning curve, but his riding and his lap times don't suggest that there is one, almost. And that was
true.
Pretty much what happened in his in his second year in Moto2. He just reset, went again, and was pretty much unbeatable. And Tony Arbolino was his biggest challenger and quickly fell off. With that consistency that Acosta was able to demonstrate.
Yeah, so 2023, he had 7 wins. It was pretty dominant. You know, he finished the races and he dominated the championship. Pete, I want to talk about his personality because I read a group report. It was in Italy, and they talked about the personality that Acosta reminds him of Valentino Rossi a little bit. You know, the celebrations. We've seen the one last year. I thought it's still hilarious. The pizza box celebration. You know, he arrived in the pit lane. He was handing out these pizza boxes. He even handed one to Tony Arbolino's mechanic in a bit of a sarcastic way. You know, he wore the lederhosen in Austria. I think he said before that he wants people to, you know, have someone that they can just have a laugh at, essentially, and, you know, shows that he's not really taking it too seriously.
Yeah, exactly. He's showing that he hasn't got this ego or anything about him in that way, is he? And I think going right back to his background, you know, his dad's a fisherman.
Yeah,
he comes from a humble background. The whole shark thing, isn't it? I think that was on his dad's boat, maybe.
That's true.
Where it came from. So he's, you know, he brings all that with him. He's a working class guy, lad, you could almost say, it's still a teenager. And he acts in that way. He's got no pretentiousness about him. No, you know, I'm a big star. There's none of that. As you say, Akiai, I'm sure, has played a good part in keeping him grounded. But even so, his whole family atmosphere is that way as well. So that's that side of things. And then you've got the... At the same time, he understands, it's almost a contrast, but as you're saying, he understands that it's a show. You know, people come to be entertained. They want somebody that they can, you know, get to know more than just the race result. They want someone they can really root for, and they want the excitement and the battles and the controversy sometimes. He gets all that, doesn't he? And it is exceptional that at such a young age, he does understand more than just riding the bike. And I think that's where... The comparison that you're making with Rossi is also valid, in that Rossi obviously understood it was about more than just what you did during the sessions on the bike. So I think that's definitely the case.
Yeah, and you know, Rob, we've seen people in the past, you know, I think of Jorge Lorenzo, he loved the celebration too, of course, planting Lorenzo's land flag in the gravel and stuff. I mean, a lot of people didn't like that, maybe because, you know, Lorenzo was around the time of Valentino Rossi, and you know what it was like, it was very heated between those two, but you get characters who just want to show themselves, and Acosta comes across in such a, how can I say, in an age of social media, he's gold dust, essentially. You know, I even seen on MotoGP's Instagram, they had a behind-the-scenes camera from the weekend, and he said that, I think he was speaking to a journalist, and they were like, "Are you flying home tonight from Portimao?" And he says, no, I'm 8-hour drive in the van. You know, like, just that little type of... He's relatable in that sense. That's what people really want to see with their riders, especially.
Yeah, and I think there's to sort of make that comparison with Rossi, there's a sort of charisma that he's got. That's just, it's sort of lovable and it is very grounded, but you sort of get the impression, like, you know, that he knows where he is and what he does, you know, for a living. Like, he's in a very good position. He's this young teenager riding MotoGP bikes, but he doesn't let it faze him. And he's got this personality that is, I think, relatable for a lot of people. And like you said, in the current generation where social media is king, he's perfect for it. There's even with his team, you see it after the race, the joke about the L plate,
which is
hilarious, because a lot of riders come into MotoGP and you don't sort of see them have anything like that, anything relatable or something that's a bit of a joke that people can have a laugh from. And he's got that. And the fact that he has such a good relationship with his team as well, that they can be that way and they can be so relaxed on a race weekend, is, I think, testament to him and the team that he's in and the environment that's being created. Then at the same time, when you take his personality away and you just, the rider himself, you sort of, it's almost like he's molded between Rossi and Marquez, because his riding style is a little bit like Marc Marquez.
Yeah.
Quite aggressive. Obviously, I can't count on two hands how many saves he's had in the first two rounds. He had another one trying to overtake Bagnaia, which was very Marc Marquez-esque. Just the total package that he has is incredible. He's lovable off the track. His riding style is lovable on the track. And I think just going forward, he's exactly what MotoGP need.
Yeah.
And I think he's destined for a lot of success in MotoGP.
And just little things as well. You know, when you think, when he joined the championship, he still is a kid when you think about it, but he couldn't speak really any English. And then Akiayo, whatever Akiayo does, you know, they all put them through this where, you know, they are PR trained to media, but not in a sort of regimented way. They learn English really well. They come across to the media very well. How important is that for someone of, like you say, he's like a sponge. He just absorbs everything. How important is that for someone's development?
Yeah, I mean, it's to be any kind of top sportsman these days, isn't it? You need to have that in your armory, the ability to communicate to everybody, because also with social media, you can reach so many people directly,
yes,
now, can't you? That you don't even need to go through a TV screen almost. So yeah, it's definitely part of it. And yeah, he's learned from all the people that came before, hasn't he? I think his idols are guys like Kevin Schwantz and Casey, yeah, Stoner. So again, you know, you put those two together, you've got the personality, the flamboyance, and then that awesome riding style of Casey Stoner as well. So you sort of see that. And yeah, you know, he's heavy braking seems to be the area that he particularly enjoys on the bike, which again adds up with what Rob was saying about Marc Marquez's riding style. And we all know Marc on the brakes, don't we, from all those years at Honda. So yeah, he is, you can see bits of a lot of famous riders in what he does, but at the same time, he's still Pedro Acosta. It's not artificial. He's not trying to mimic somebody or to be somebody he isn't. It's very natural, and that's the key, because people know if something is not real, don't they, or if someone's trying to be something they're not. He always seems, look, I'm just being myself. He quipped on the weekend, for example, someone asked him about the spec of his bike, and he said, look, I'm not my crew chief. I don't know. I just ride it. You know, I mean, it's a natural reply. It's not scripted what he does. And I think that's the key thing as well.
Yeah. And by the end of his Moto2 career, we knew he was going into MotoGP. And, you know, signing for Hervé Poncharal's team, Rob, it was a clear indication that KTM wanted to give him full backing. You know, we've seen it this year, even whatever the factory KTM team are testing, he has it as well. You know, he's treated like the third factory rider. And from that first test in Valencia, you know, it was a big day. Of course, Marc Marquez on the Ducati for the first time. But the other story was that was Pedro Acosta, and just how he adapted so quickly. You know, he wasn't afraid to drop the ride height device after a few laps. He was loving that. And just even his first comments, you know, you really seen, you know, he's made for MotoGP. He really wants this.
Yeah, I think he couldn't have landed in a better position. Obviously, to be on a KTM, which is one of the top three bikes on the grid, was a perfect environment to be in. But then at the same time, like we spoke about with Akiayo, I think a lot of credit has to go to Hervé Poncharal for the job he does with young riders and, yep, that team. And he seems to be able to get the best more often than not out of a young rider and make them feel comfortable more than anything. And we've seen already through, you know, the winter period and the first two rounds, that relationship he's got with Poncharal. And I think,
yeah,
that for Acosta is big, that he has someone who can be so relatable and almost like a very rider-friendly team principal, and someone who can always be there and always give him what he needs to go fast, essentially. And then to your point about Valencia, you know, when he came into pit lane and was, well, can't repeat the words on the podcast, but he was very, very excited by the potential of a MotoGP bike. And I think it was Maverick Vinales who, after a couple of laps, he was trying to follow and almost race.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's just, he couldn't help it. It's just that young attitude and wanted to prove himself. And I think, you know, what he did in Valencia was impressive. What he did throughout testing was, we've spoken about it before, was immense. And it's just like it's been throughout his whole career. It's just been, in a very short period of time, a just a continuous upwards trajectory that doesn't appear like it's stopping. And I think going forward, that team is going to be great for him this year. Obviously, remains to be seen what happens next year.
Yeah.
Potentially joining the factory team. That's something that KTM will probably already considering. But I think Acosta is in a perfect situation for the next, well, for this year and going forward.
Yeah, like Rob says, Pete, you know, he is in probably the best setup that he could have had in his career. When you think about the KTM program, you know, like I say, Red Bull Rookies champion, Moto3 champion, all on KTMs. And then you get to Moto2, of course, he's in the IO Red Bull KTM team setup. It just is perfect for his development as he heads into MotoGP to be riding on a KTM. He essentially is the golden egg that they have. And, you know, what it was like for so many years, Pete. There was so much talk of Marc Marquez going to KTM, and that would be the final piece. But in the space of, what, 3 years, we've seen the golden egg come out of Moto3, and it is Pedro Acosta.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it sort of, everything came together, hasn't it, with Acosta. In a way, KTM, they tried sort of bringing in a big star rider, Johann Zarco, wasn't it? That was their idea. We need to get a top rider in, and that will be the way to success. That obviously went completely wrong. So then they went back, and they've gone to a system that, a bit like Ducati, where you train the young riders up, don't you? You bring them in young, as we've seen Ducati doing in recent years. So they're not afraid to change them. You know, if they realize something isn't working, they'll change tact and go completely with it. And, you know, so they concentrated on the young guys. Acosta was there, so it's the right moment, right time. And he comes in, perfect, it's super talent. As you guys have said, he's in with Hervé Contrarel's team, which is all ideal situation for a rookie, isn't it? The full factory support, technically, but also that family atmosphere that we heard Marc Marquez talk about at Gressini. Well, that's what Acosta's got at the Tectoire team now. So you've got that mix of, you haven't got all that pressure that you get if you're in a factory team of results, results, results. You know, it's obviously pressure. You need to perform, but it is a different atmosphere, I think, in a satellite team, and especially teams like Hervé Pancharal. So that's working well. You then look at who's alongside him, Paul Trefathen, his crew chief.
Yeah.
He was with Paul Espargaró, you know, for years. That was a really successful partnership. They seem to have hit it off straight away, don't they? And I think that's important. It's interesting because there is this big age gap, you know, that there wasn't with Paul Trevathan and Paul Espargaró. They were much nearer, and then also nearer just in terms of both having young families and that kind of thing. Here in comes a teenager, you know, to work with in Acosta, to work with Paul. And yet straight away, they have this great relationship. And we've seen in the past, it often works that way. Rossi, Jerry Burgess, big age gap there. Lorenzo, Ramon Fulcada. So interesting that they, well, and crucial to his success, that they've instantly had that bond as a rider and a crew chief. And of course, if in the future he does change teams, let's see what happens there. But Paul Trevathan would surely go with him. So he's got that assurance that he's going to have that partnership with him wherever he goes. But for his rookie year, I think, as you guys have said, perfect place to be in Tectoire.
I like the comparison you made there about the crew chief relationship. You know, as so crucial, like you say, you know, McDoon, Gary Burgess, and then Rossi just inherited that, and you've seen just how that worked out. You know, even Santi Hernandez, Marc Marquez from the Moto2 days, it just built an incredible relationship. Like you said, with Paul Trevathan and Pedro Acosta, I really like that point with the age gap. You know, he probably can't believe who he has. You know, he has someone that's, like you say, it's like a sponge, and we'll just go, yeah, if you want to do that, we'll do it. And it's just, if it doesn't work, whatever, we'll try something else. Like, you know, it's only his second Grand Prix that he had in MotoGP, and he's already finished on the podium, you know, third youngest ever in the Premier class, Rob. It's just, what's going to happen next for Pedro Acosta?
The sky is the limit. You know, he's got, I think it's by Sachsenring, to become the youngest ever MotoGP race winner, which, you know, given the speed he's shown, we probably all thought that maybe some top fives in the first half of the season, maybe the odd podium, but the fact that he's had a podium already, and his speed isn't slowing down. He's only going to get stronger as the season goes on. I think at least more podiums, if not a win, is achievable by Sachsenring, by that magic number to become the youngest. He's the sort of rider who won't say that that's something that's on his mind, and I genuinely believe that to be the case. But if he's got the potential to achieve such a result,
yeah,
I think we're gonna see him start to really, really push in a race to try and achieve that. Because for a lot of Spaniards, Marc Márquez is the guy to look to. The success he's had, the riding style, everything about Marc Márquez for a young Spanish rider is something to feed off and to look towards. As an icon of the sport. And for Acosta, P made a great point. He's got parts of him that are maybe a little bit like Marc Márquez, but he's Pedro Acosta at the end of the day. He's his own man.
Yeah.
He'll want to prove that Pedro Acosta is better than Marc Márquez. He doesn't want to replicate. He wants to be his own rider. And just the point about the team that he's in and working with his crew chief, something that I think also is going to help him this year before he goes into a factory team. Not that it's something that would probably bother him, but the fact that he's joined MotoGP as a rookie and doesn't have a superstar teammate next to him, like a Brad Binder or a Bagnaia, someone who's ready to win the world title and push the project on to a really high degree. I think having someone like Augusto Fernandez, who's in his second year and seems to be struggling actually so far, I think that that's just helped the team almost say, we haven't got a superstar that we need to take care of. Acosta's already becoming our superstar, and they can really focus in on Acosta, who then, that point about Marc Márquez joining KTM, there's almost no room for him anymore because Binder's not going anywhere. In terms of the factory team, Acosta is the rider to go to now. So I think the sky is the limit for him this year. I think a race win at some point is definitely on the cards.
Yeah, I really like that point, Rob, about the teammates. So, like I say, he was in that environment when Remy Gardner won the Moto2 world title. He was Moto3, obviously, and they both were world champions. He then was teammates with Augusto in 22 when Augusto won the world title. And he's kind of, it's a good thing he's been surrounded by people that have won world championships, and he knows what winning is like in a team. And I personally think no matter who his teammate is, he doesn't care. I think he will just go, okay, if they're faster than me, they're faster. I can learn from this. And we've no, from his CV and his talent, he will get there eventually. He will just be able to match them, beat them. Incredible. And like you said about the Sachsenring, that'll be the race that he has until then. I just had this thought that imagine it was Marc Márquez versus Pedro Acosta at the Sachsenring. That would be now Liberty Media, if you are listening to this, that's a reason for you to buy MotoGP. That would be the marketing dream.
Sachsenring.
That would be the media dream, so it would. But yeah, Pedro Acosta, the sky is the limit, and I can't wait for this season. Enjoyed that chat, guys. Very good. And I hope that Pedro just keeps going the way he does, because we're very lucky to have someone like him in our sport. If you enjoyed the show, make sure to subscribe, give us a rating on Apple Podcasts, wherever. Follow us on Spotify. You'll never miss an episode. Make sure to like the video on YouTube. Subscribe to our YouTube channel as well. Head to Christ.net for everything MotoGP, and of course, all the other motorsports that we cover. And until next time, we'll see you then.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.